Well, hello everyone and welcome to
Tracing Text
with Anton
and Sylvia,
coming to you from deep in the heart of the state of Tennessee.
Yes, and today we are recording our podcast number 9. Anton is going to be discussing Emilio Carrere's La Torre de los Siete Jorobados, or The Tower of the Seven Hunchbacks. So, let's start out by talking a little bit about the author and who he is, a little bit about his biography.
Well, I think it's important to know a little bit about his biography because he's not a very well-known writer these days. Not much has been written about him, even though he was incredibly popular in the about 40 years of the 20th century. Emilio Carrere was born and also died in Madrid. He lived there all his life. He was born in 1881 and passed away in 1947. And he is one of the foremost representatives of the Bohemian writers and artists who lived and worked in the city of Madrid in the early to the mid-20th century.
And why do you say that he isn't as well known? Can you tell us why?
Well, there are several reasons for that. I think that one of the reasons why he's underrated and why he's forgotten today may be that he concentrated on writing popular literature. He wasn't trying to write high class, high culture.
So he was a bestseller. Literature.
He was more of a bestseller type, that's true. And that might be one of the reasons why. And he was also extremely popular.
So, right.
He definitely was one of the bestsellers of the era. But another reason might be a political reason.
Okay.
Because during the Spanish Civil War between 1936 and 1939, he claimed that he was insane to avoid taking part in the war.
Now, do you know if, like, he actually checked into a psychiatric ward, or how did he prove that, or, you know, that he was insane to avoid going to war?
Well, I don't know the specifics of exactly how he came to do this, or if, you know, some doctor friend of his was involved or something like that.
Right.
But he definitely checked into a psychiatric ward for part of the time that the Spanish Civil War was going on. And that way he avoided going and participating in the war. But after the war, when Franco won the war, and I think, you know, Carrere decided to stay in Spain and began to lean closer to the Franco regime. In order to keep his journalistic license, and he even wrote a novel in celebration of the new regime called La Ciudad de los Siete Puñales, The City of the Seven Daggers. And, you know, obviously not being a Franco supporter at first, then he became one. So there are certain critics who dislike that for obvious reasons.
So really it was more about maintaining that, you know, we had discussed in a previous podcast that they had to have a journalistic license. So maybe his core beliefs were not as right-leaning, but he saw that as a means to be able to continue publishing, or did he, in fact, kind of switch his point of view?
Yeah, there's no, I don't think there's any evidence that he actually adhered to that sort of political beliefs before the war.
Okay.
In fact, a lot of his novels, a lot of his poetry, and a lot of his work in general wasn't really political in nature.
Right.
But he seemed to be more of a liberal, kind of Republican in the Spanish sense of the term.
Right.
Before the war, but after the war, he just leaned closer to the victors.
And, right.
For whatever reasons he had, but certainly some professional reasons, personal reasons, were in place. And I think, you know, as he leaned toward the beliefs of the Franco regime, he also used his position to try and help some of his family members and friends that may have been in trouble during that very difficult time.
Right. Okay. That's interesting.
Now, another thing that we need to talk about a little bit is that Bohemian group of writers.
Yeah.
Many of these writers who lived in Madrid, around the turn of the century and the first few decades of the 20th century, were actually worthless writers. They were not very good. If you read, for example, a book by Juan Manuel de Prada called Desgarrados y Excéntricos.
Sounds very melodramatic.
It is, yeah. They were quite melodramatic. And if you read that book, you'll basically read about a parade of really strange characters, really weird, really odd people that were a part of the of this group. But some of them, for example, Alejandro Sawa, Ramón María del Valle Inclán, Ramón Gómez de la Serna, they wrote some really valuable works. They are really famous and important writers in the 20th century in Spain. Emilio Carrere was not as famous, I don't think, has not remained, let's say, as famous as these writers I'm talking about. But he was still a really popular writer in the early to mid-20th century, and in my opinion, his works are valuable as well.
Okay, and you mentioned that that he fits with the Bohemian writers, but what in fact made them, quote, Bohemian writers? Was it their lifestyle or the actual writing, the style of writing?
Well, it was more of a lifestyle, you know, that actually seeped into their writing as well.
Okay.
It was the lifestyle of these people who just hung out at different cafes, who didn't have a lot of money, who were always trying to, you know, sell their works, and it wasn't always easy to do that. A lot of them tried to trick their way through life to try and earn some money the easy way, but most of them were poor. They were not in very good financial standing. And, you know, besides being a literary, I wouldn't say movement, but at least group, it was also a way of life for a lot of them. And again, that book by Juan Manuel de Prada, Desgarrados y Excéntricos, which unfortunately has not been translated translated into English yet, gives a very good and I think a very thorough account of some of the most interesting, let's say, some of the weirdest, the strangest among these writers. But, you know, for most of his life, Carrere lived quite comfortably because he had a job as a civil servant, and at some point he inherited some money from his father. So this bohemian lifestyle was a personal choice for him.
So he was like a hipster.
Brought about by necessity. He was the ultimate hipster of the Spanish turn of the century.
Right.
But by choice.
By choice, in
his
yeah.
case. At least That's most why... of his life it was by choice. Yeah. He just enjoyed that sort of lifestyle.
Right.
He was a multifaceted writer, a poet, he wrote essays, he was a journalist, he appeared on radio in the early days of radio, he wrote zarzuelas.
We talked about those.
For those of you who may not know what those are, they're like
operettas,
yeah, right? Yeah, like in Spanish operettas, in Spanish, not as good as other operettas that were produced in Europe. In some cases, it was definitely not as good as Italian opera, but it was incredibly popular in Spain, and there's still this tradition.
And even in Latin America, I would say.
Yeah, definitely. And still to this day, they remain somewhat popular.
I remember watching them as a child.
Well, he wrote some. He wrote some throughout his life. Not too many, but he did write some. But I find him at his very best, not as a poet, but as a narrator, especially as a writer of short novels, las novelas cortas.
Okay.
And he only wrote one long novel, and that long novel really wasn't much longer than 200 pages, is La Torre de los Siete Jorobados, which was first published in 1920, The Tower of the Seven Hunchbacks, and that's basically the book that we're talking about today.
Now, the title seems to me like a mix of Victor Hugo's The Hunchback of Notre Dame and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. So, can you tell us a little bit about the novel?
Yes, we'll get to the novel in just a bit. If you think the title is strange,
it is quite strange.
Just wait until you hear what the novel is
about.
Okay, we'll leave you hanging there for a little longer.
Because this is a fantastic title.
It's actually a very attractive title.
Right.
That is for sure. You're listening to Tracing Texts with Anton.
And Sylvia.
And today we're talking about Emilio Carrere and the Tower of the Seven Hunchbacks. we were saying that Carrere was born in Madrid, and he died in Madrid and lived in Madrid all his life. And also a great deal of his literary work is set in Madrid. So he has been called one of the great madrileñistas. That means writers who take the city of Madrid as their main subject matter. And he does that in most of his short novels, including The Tower of the Seven Hunchbacks, that are actually set in Madrid. What he did throughout his life, he loved to walk around the city of Madrid. He spent tons of time in its cafes discussing literature, discussing art, having coffee with friends, and writing his works in the cafes themselves. Pretty much like we're doing now, since you know, you're having your tea there
and you have your coffee.
Yeah, a little bit like Carrere.
Exactly.
It's a little bit of a tribute to Emilio Carrere. And since you were asking about the Bohemian lifestyle, a sizable number of his works actually deal with the Bohemian lifestyle, and they're set in cafes, and they feature artists as its main protagonists. They focus on low-life characters many times, poor artists, thieves, pimps, prostitutes, drunks, and several others. I would say that at his worst, Carrere could write works that were trite, that were predictable, but at his best, and I think The Tower of the Seven Hunchbacks is one of his best, he's always able to treat all his subjects, and not just the characters, but also the subjects of the novels and the works, with dry humor, with compassion, and it's really a very attractive writer, I think. I can tell you for sure that he is always a very entertaining author, as you can already tell from that title.
Yes.
La Torre de los Siete Jorobados.
He definitely wants, you know, he entices you to want to read his works.
Now, since Carrere was mostly known as a poet, or, well, most remembered, let's say, as a poet, let me tell you a little bit about his poetic works, just very, very briefly. He was a modernist, and within modernism, he's usually described as a decadentist, from, you know, the turn of the century, fin de siècle writer. He was incredibly influenced by Rubén Darío, whom he adored, and he really wanted to write his poetry in the style of Rubén Darío, but it seems that he didn't enjoy hanging out with Rubén Darío because he absolutely hated drunks.
He loved his work, but not so much hanging out with him on a regular basis.
Yeah, not necessarily, but he really idolized Darío, and you can see this when you read his very modernist poetry. He was the first man in Spain who published an anthology of modernist poetry, including, of course, some of his own poems. not just Darío and several one of the other modernists, but also himself.
He made sure to include himself in that anthology.
He needed to be there. The anthology is called La Corte de los Poetas, The Court of Poets, and was published in 1906. I just think his poetry is a little repetitive. Not as fresh, not as creative as that of other modernist masters like Rubén Darío, for example.
So many others, yeah.
And of course he was influenced by the French poets like Rimbaud and Verlaine, Mallarmé.
Which the Latin American modernists were influenced by those French poets as well.
Yes, and in fact, you know, one of his books, which is actually a collection of essays about life and about literature, about different things, is called The Cup of Verlaine.
Oh, okay.
La Copa de Verlaine.
Okay, so cool.
It's actually an interesting book as well. As I said, he was better known as a poet, and people from all walks of life knew his poems by heart in Madrid and in other parts of Spain. He was very popular in all the widest possible sense of the term. And even today, really, most of the articles that one can find about him, and some of them you can find on the internet, and you can, you know, download and read for free, they deal mostly with his poetry, a lot more so than with his fiction, with his prose. But I like his prose better, just personally. I think he was a much more interesting writer as a fiction writer, as a narrator, than as a prose writer, than as a poet, really. Although, you know, his poetry is interesting. You know, one may read it and enjoy it, but it's not. I don't think it's the best of his output.
Really. Right. Okay. So what about his fiction? Like, now that we've talked a little bit about his poetry, his influences, who he admired, but let's look at some of that prose.
Yes. Well, the prose... Let's say, most of all, that he was a master of the short novel, mm-hmm. La novela corta. That genre in Spanish literature has been there pretty much the beginning.
And it's very popular. Many writers still
Yes, and these days it's still quite popular, not just in Spain, but also in Latin America.
Exactly, which is not the case in the English-speaking world. Novellas don't do as well.
Yeah, not so much. So really, it's novellas that he excelled at writing, so short novels. Mm-hmm. It was particularly popular, the mm-hmm. short novel, at the turn of the 20th century. And the reason for that in Spain was the creation of weekly publications that offered short novels at affordable prices.
Well, that could be part of the reason.
That's one reason. I think an important economic reason, let's say.
Right.
And these popular publications are... for example, La Novela Corta, the short novel, El Cuento Semanal, the weekly tale or the weekly story, Los Contemporáneos, La Novela de Hoy, the novel of today. This was really popular literature that came out weekly.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be bought in bookstores, it could be bought at newsstands even.
Right.
For example, every Saturday some of these collections would come out. And,
so they had a very diverse audience.
Really diverse audience, and actually an audience that was mixed in gender.
Okay,
so
that's
it was
interesting
not, it
as
was
well.
Not just men, but also it was also marketed towards women.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I think that more work needs to be done on these weekly publications in Spain, because they are very important and explain a lot about the development of the novel in Spain in the 20th century. And these books that were published weekly, it was popular literature written by both established authors
mm-hmm.
and newcomers.
Right.
So this offered the chance to new writers to publish their work
mm-hmm.
And actually circulated widely. These publications have been criticized by some critics for the low quality of the texts that they offered. Now, I don't really think that's true.
Okay.
Because... besides some of the newer writers of the era,
right,
including Carrere, for example, renowned writers such as Emilia Pardo Bazán, Vicente Blasco Ibáñez,
mm-hmm.
Pío Baroja, Valle Inclán, and many, many others
contributed
works, short works, short novels to these publications.
Right. And those are very canonical authors.
They are, and some of them took it seriously too.
Right.
It wasn't like they were doing it just for the money.
Right.
They actually took it seriously, and some really interesting novels came out in this way. Carrere, of course, contributed not just to one, but to many of these publications, and his short novels were among the most popular of mm-hmm. this kind of fiction at mm-hmm. this time. If we talk about themes, for example, mm-hmm. for the novels that he wrote for La Novela Corta or El Cuento Semanal, we find novels that range from erotic to mystery to adventure to detective novels to stories about the low life of Madrid.
So a wide range.
Yes.
Did he have particular authors that influenced this like vast range of thematic elements?
Yes, definitely. For example, we could talk about the influence of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, for example.
Uh-huh.
That's for sure. Jules Verne, the French
right.
writer, and of course the American Edgar Allan Poe.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Carrere translated some of the short stories by Edgar Allan Poe into Spanish using the French translation by Baudelaire.
Very interesting that it goes through like a double translation.
Yes, I think in this case it was necessary because Carré didn't speak English.
Right, I mean,
and he didn't really speak French, but he could understand French.
Right.
Could read French, I guess, at
right.
least. And so it was easier for him
to translate.
Now his short novels are characterized by short chapters, short sentences, lots of metaphors. They're very entertaining. They're well written, and they're fairly easy to read.
Mm-hmm.
So the one we'll be talking about today is not one of these, really, because it wasn't published in that way. It wasn't one of these weekly publications. But it's also fairly easy to read, and even though La Torre de los Siete Jorobados has not really been translated into English, as far as I know,
mm-hmm.
It's fairly easy to read, I think, for advanced students of Spanish.
Right. I mean, it seems really ideal for our students and for, you know, 21st century students. So
yes, like, because they're short novels, a lot of them, and, you know, a lot of them have a lot of action to
right.
them, and they're interesting not just because of the themes or the topics, but also because of the plot.
Right.
What's happening in the plot. So it could be a very plot-driven sort of reading
mm-hmm.
for, you know, some advanced students of Spanish. So, yeah, Carrere, even though some of his novels, you know, deal with difficult situations,
right.
you know, a lot of them deal with the underworld, you know. But a lot of them don't, and a lot of them are basically just adventure novels.
So there's plenty to choose from.
You're listening to a new episode of Tracing Texts.
With Sylvia.
And Anton. And I know Sylvia should have said that tracing text, but I just jumped in.
That's right okay. There. We don't have to be the same
That's
all
right.
the time. We can be spontaneous.
Now, let's talk about something very interesting about
okay.
Carrere, which was his understanding of literature.
Okay, so tell me about that.
He understood literature as a sort of business.
Okay.
And in that way, he often republished the same texts with very few alterations and with different titles.
Now, that sounds very, like, if we were talking about plagiarism,
yes.
this would be a big no-no in the academic world and also the publishing world in general. So how did he manage to do this without, you know, repercussions, shall we say?
Well, fortunately, he wasn't an academic.
Good.
So that's a good start there. And, you know, some critics have talked about self-plagiarism,
mm-hmm.
because he wasn't necessarily plagiarizing
right.
the novels of other people, although sometimes he would get ideas from novels
right.
that he read by somebody else.
But still,
it was often his own novels.
But still, that's kind of seen as a no-no, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. But in this case, it's even hard to even call it self-plagiarism, because what he's doing is he's presenting exactly the same text.
He's not even
with a different
like,
title.
He's not really doing anything except changing the
title. Nothing different. So sometimes he didn't even bother to make any changes at all.
Uh-huh.
You know, he simply switched the titles, but the text was exactly the same. Sometimes just minor changes. Sometimes he would add a chapter or two. He would use a previously published short story, and he would add some chapters. And all of a sudden, voila, you have a short novel,
mm-hmm.
You know. So yeah, there was a lot of self-plagiarism, as some of these critics have noted. And he would also republish, listen to this, several novels in one volume and presented them as unpublished.
That's very clever.
But they had been published previously,
right.
you know, so... as a result, Carrere is usually known as el maestro del refrito, which
means
the master of refried, not refried beans.
That's what it makes me think of, like
but refried texts.
Mexican refried beans.
Refried novels.
Yeah.
And that makes his works really difficult to catalog, because sometimes you have several titles for the same novel, or several titles for a novel that is basically the same with
right.
a few minor changes. Here and there.
Right.
So
that he basically would make a new anthology of his own work.
That's right. It's a pretty, you know, I think the postmodernist would love this sort of thing. Right?
I mean, it's an interesting way, like an analysis would be a very interesting analysis of how he does this.
But actually, he didn't do it for any reason other than making money.
So
there's no deep reason.
Man.
He's not trying to prove anything. He was just trying to make a buck.
Okay.
And that's basically what he's doing. He didn't feel either, you know, any sort of remorse regarding this practice of republishing, because in a letter, I have here a quote that I've translated into English of a letter, in which he claims that this is actually an honest practice.
And why is that, Anton?
Well,
tell us what he says.
This is a good example of the kind of person that Emilio Carrere was. This kind of man that I really would have loved to meet, you know, and spend, you know, an afternoon or a whole night. He loved being out at night.
So it would be great chatting with him.
I would love to have some coffee
or have a beer or something.
Yeah, and chat with him. So this is how he justifies this practice of republication. He says, songwriters make money every time one of their songs is sung. And we, meaning the writers, are only paid once when we sell something we write. We should receive royalties every time someone reads one of our poems, novels, or articles. Until we reach this sort of agreement, I will republish anything I want. And then he adds, it's just a matter of changing titles.
Well, he does have a point there, because maybe not every time a song is sung, but, you know, every time they play a song in the radio, there is a royalty associated with that. So, to some extent, I can see where he's coming from.
Yeah, I mean, and in fact, I think that the only people who could probably feel deceived, rather than the publishers, would be his audience, his
readers. Right, because they thought they're buying a new novel, when in fact they've already read that.
And sometimes he's republishing novels or reworking texts that he published maybe three years before.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very possible that, you know, some reader has read this under a different title, and then, you know, he goes to the newsstand or to the bookstore and buys another one, thinking that it's a different novel because it has a different title, and voila, again, it's the same. Hey, this sounds, you know, it's a little bit of the deja vu here, because
it does sound that way.
But that's what he did. It doesn't make him a less interesting writer or author for doing that. It's simply something, let's say, rather odd that he used to do.
Now, you said that the critics looked at this negatively, but his audience, his readers, did they ever like write to him or complain, like, I bought this novel and then I buy another one that thinking is something totally different and it's not, you know? Or,
well, I really have not been able to find any evidence of that. Mm-hmm. I'm still obviously working on Emilio Carrere. He's a writer I've liked for a long time, you know, since I first read the Tower of the Seven Hunchbacks. But I have not really found any evidence that speaks to what you're talking about. There's a couple of books that I have here on the table about him, because not a lot has been written about him, but in the last, let's say, 15 years or so, maybe a couple of books have been published about him. One of them is called Emilio Carrere, Un Bohemio.
Question mark,
wondering if he really was a bohemian or not, right, because of what we talked about before.
He was not truly a bohemian. It was just his life, what he chose to, like, how he manifested himself to the world.
That's right, and one wonders, why is this particular of Carrere alone and not the others who are the true bohemians?
Right.
Because actually throughout his life he was seen as the bohemian to end all bohemians,
right,
by a lot of his audience. But he himself disliked sometimes the bohemians, and sometimes he liked them. So, you know, it's hard to tell,
right,
if he really thought of himself as a bohemian, mm-hmm, or not. He probably did part of the time, but maybe not all of the time. That book, Emilio Carrere, Un Bohemio, is by Jaime Álvarez Sánchez, who lives in Móstoles, near Madrid.
Okay.
And he's a teacher at high school there, as far as I know. And then we have this other book, Emilio Carrere, El Bohemio de Madrid.
Madrid. There's no question about it. This author believes that he was, in fact, a bohemian.
And this author is Alejandro Riera Guignet.
Okay.
And I really don't know him personally or anything. But I think he was the librarian, I don't know if he still is, but at some point he was the librarian of the casino in Madrid.
Okay.
And actually his book answers the question, Emilio Carrere, Un Bohemio, Emilio Carrere, El Bohemio de Madrid. So those are two books that, you know, anyone who reads Spanish and might be interested in the life of Carrere and what it means to be a bohemian, un bohemio.
Right.
You know, you could find those books fairly easy on Amazon or, right, you know, any other online retailer. You're listening to
Tracing Text.
I did it right this time. With Anton
and Sylvia.
And now it's time to finally
get to the novel.
Get to the novel, La Torre de los Siete Jorobados.
Right.
It's a novel that Carrera wrote or published in 1920.
Okay.
But it has a very interesting story behind the composition and the publication of this novel. It's the only full-length novel by him, and it is interesting because he didn't write the whole text himself.
Oh, so who did he work with?
So he was well-known for writing short novels.
Okay.
And in this case, he wanted to publish a full-length novel. And so what did he do? He based it, mm-hmm. So he was basically refrying,
uh-huh.
Right? Rewriting a short story that he had published a few years before, entitled El Señor Catafalco,
mm-hmm.
Mr. Catafalco, right? And so he lengthened that short story, he sold the manuscript to his publisher, but the novel still wasn't long enough to warrant publication as a full-length novel.
Mm-hmm.
But when Carrera refused to make it longer, so his publisher said, right. You have to make it longer because
right.
It's not long enough. He said, no, I already sold it to you. I'm not going to be working on mm-hmm. it anymore. So the publisher, whose name was Manuel Palomeque,
uh-huh.
He was forced to find another writer that would lengthen the text. And that's when he called on Jesús de Palacios.
Uh-huh.
Now, who was Jesús de Palacios? He was a writer who was starting at that point his literary career. And he was very glad to take on the job.
Was he actually acknowledged when it was finally published, or was he more of a ghostwriter?
He was totally a ghostwriter.
Okay, so it was like when they bought the book, Jesús de Palacios is not even mentioned.
That's right. They bought the book. Carrera didn't want to finish it. It was finished. He just didn't want to make it longer.
Right.
And so the publisher called on Palacios and asked him to make the novel longer.
Right.
But of course, the name of Jesús de Palacios does not appear on the cover of the novel, and even in the more modern editions, it still only says Emilio Carrera. The interesting thing about Palacios is that after he took on this job and the novel was published, he subsequently became a very popular writer of adventure novels. Sometime known as Spain's Jules Verne.
Right, which people know very well.
And he often signed his works with a pseudonym, that of Capitán Sirius, or Captain Sirius.
Sounds like Star Trek-y to me.
Yeah, it's a little strange, but he often did this. And there were some other writers at the time that did something similar. Now, it was once thought that Palacios wrote about 50%
mm-hmm.
of The Tower of the Seven Hunchbacks. But we now know that his contribution was a lot smaller. There
mm-hmm.
were two critics that wrote a very interesting article, fairly
mm-hmm.
long, but very interesting, entitled something like The Genesis of The Tower of the Seven Hunchbacks. And I can't remember now the title, the name of these two critics. But the title of the article is The Genesis of the Tower of the Seven Hunchbacks. And they found out that his contribution was a lot smaller.
Mm-hmm.
Palacios probably just added a few chapters toward the middle of the novel and then rewrote parts of other chapters. But it's difficult to tell exactly how much he wrote, exactly how much we're not sure. Well, this line is by Palacios, this line is by Carrera. We don't know because they didn't work together.
Right, it's almost like an extensive editing process.
That's right, it's almost like he's padding
right.
the novel to make it longer. But he did a good job because it's hard to tell. It's really hard to tell. Just to the naked eye, it's really hard to tell. But in any case, most of the novel actually comes from the pen of Emilio Carrera. It became one of the most popular titles ever written by Emilio Carrera. It was reissued several times throughout
mm-hmm.
his life. But incredibly enough, despite the success it had,
Mm-hmm.
And the fact, we will talk about this to end the episode, that there was a film later on made about the novel. There are not too many modern editions of La Torre de los Siete Jorobados. Okay. Right now I can think of maybe two or three.
That's it.
In the last 30 years, maybe.
Is it something that students are required to read maybe in high school or university? It's just because it's still... There is sufficient interest where there are some editions out there that are being published.
There are some... There was particularly one critic who was very interested, because he was a big fan of his literature, and he was really interested in republishing a lot of his short novels and short stories, and also La Torre de los Siete Jorobados, and... You know, his name was actually Jesús Palacios.
Not Jesús de Palacios, but just Jesús Palacios.
That's right, exactly. and in fact, you know, come to think of it, Sylvia, now that I'm talking about this, I realized that I mixed up the names.
Okay.
So Jesús Palacios is the critic.
Okay.
You know, and the name of this writer, who was known as the Jules Verne of Spain,
mm-hmm.
was not Jesús de Palacios, but Jesús de Aragón.
De Aragón.
Jesús
okay.
de Aragón, yeah.
Okay.
As I was writing this, now as I was reading this, I realized that I had made that mistake. Jesús de Aragón is the writer that padded the novel.
Okay.
But Jesús de Palacios, or Jesús Palacios, is the writer or the critic who has been republishing some of the novels by Carrere, a lot of them since the mid to late 90s up to now. So I'm sorry about that. It's not really Jesús de Palacios that helped write this novel. His name was Jesús de Aragón.
Right.
Okay. And Jesús de Aragón is Captain Sirius,
mm-hmm.
and he is the man who was known as the Spanish Jules Verne
mm-hmm.
At the time, but who didn't publish any novels after the Spanish Civil War.
Oh, interestingly. Right.
So, anyway.
So what kind of genre would you categorize this novel as?
So, it's really a mixture of different genres, you know, a kind of pastiche of sorts, adventure, mystery, detective, gothic novel, and this is interesting because the gothic novel was really not a genre that was cultivated in Spain very
probably
much.
Probably only like by Inclán to some extent could be considered gothic,
In some of that, yes, but...
Right.
It's really
not all of it. No.
Yeah, it's really not. It's really not a genre that was in any way very popular in Spain. There are some examples, but not many. And this would be a really late Gothic novel.
Right, because
you know.
We think of the Gothic in general much earlier.
Yeah, 19th century at least, and this is a novel from 1920. Now, let's talk a little bit about the plot, because
okay.
I think you wanted to know about that.
Oh, yes, most definitely.
The plot moves at a very, very, very swift pace, and it concerns Basilio
uh-huh.
and a journalist known simply as El Duende de la Corte,
okay.
the court goblin, which
okay.
was probably just the pseudonym that this fictional journalist used in his articles, I suppose. So the two of them, Basilio and the court goblin, investigate the mysterious murder of Mr. Catafalco, and that's where that previous short story comes in.
Okay.
It's called El Señor Catafalco.
Right.
The real name of Mr. Catafalco turns out to be Dr. Robinson of Mantua, for a reason that really doesn't really matter, but it's part of the novel. And so the ghost of Mr. Catafalco appears unto Basilio and communicates to him that he has been murdered.
So he's dead.
He's dead, but the ghost shows up in front of Basilio, and by means of automatic writing on a piece of paper...
That seems surrealist to
yes,
me.
Yes, and he says to him that he is now... the person that has to find the murderer.
Okay,
so as you can see, the supernatural comes in as well.
That's
in
fantastic.
This novel. It's quite funny, really,
uh-huh.
in many ways. Now, this leads the two men, Basilio and the court goblin, to discover partly by chance, and to enter into an obscure underworld that exists in underground Madrid, and that is governed by, listen to this, a strange cult, a secret sect of hunchbacks.
That's hilarious.
And these hunchbacks, apparently you had to be a hunchback in order to be a part of this cult. They perform rituals and sacrifices and all sorts of illegal activities underground.
Are these human sacrifices or animal sacrifices?
Human sacrifices mostly. They trick people. But in any case, it's not that they live underground, but all their activities happen under the, I guess, the ground of Madrid.
Like there are tunnels or basements.
Yeah, tunnels that supposedly were
dug,
yeah, by the Jews, you know, when they were trying to escape back in medieval times and blah, blah, blah. So it's really, as you can see, some of it is absolutely astounding and ridiculous and nonsensical, but the plot
makes good storytelling.
Makes for great storytelling. And not only that, but the plot is action-packed. It remains interesting throughout its 200 pages or so. You will see that if you read it, that there are some fantastic elements. And then in the background, lurking there in the background, occultism and theosophy, which were two pseudosciences that Carrere was very interested in. He really was interested in the idea of mediums and talking to the spirits and that sort of thing.
Right.
Which was not something strange at the time, because many well-known authors and artists and even politicians,
right,
you know, people like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, for example,
mm-hmm,
you know, they were very interested in the occult and,
right,
and spirituality and that sort of thing.
Right. And theosophy, though, didn't it originate in the U.S. With Madame, what's up?
Blavatsky. Yeah,
yes,
that's right.
I knew
that's
that.
Right. That's right. That was, I think, one of the things that Carrere was most interested in, theosophy, at least throughout part of his life. I think as he grew older, he became more distanced,
mm-hmm,
but still interested. You know,
mm-hmm.
Edison, for example, you know, the inventor.
Right, he was still very much a theosophist.
Yeah, also interested in that, and he thought that maybe it would be possible to record sounds from the afterlife with his phonograph and, you know, stuff like that. So Carrere was very much into that sort of scene, and it was just as popular in Spain in the early 20th century as it was in other parts of Europe and also in the United States,
right,
as you mentioned. So now one of the things I really like about the Tower of the Seven Hunchbacks is,
mm-hmm,
is the fact that Carrere throws in a lot of humor.
Oh, that's always good to keep it light in that way.
And really, his humor is very often absurd, of the absurd kind.
Uh-huh.
Let's give an example of this,
okay,
so that you can see the kind of situation that he's able to come up with that, you know, regular mortals like you and I probably would never be able to come up with. There is a scene in the novel, actually fairly towards the middle of the novel or so, where a character is being kept as a prisoner in a pit.
Just like...
underground.
It reminds me of Edgar Allan Poe.
That's right. And it doesn't remind only you of Edgar Allan Poe. It reminds Basilio of Edgar Allan Poe, too.
So
Basilio,
it's like
the
very
character.
Intertextual or metafictional.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It is. And in fact, you know, there's several, you know, literary allusions throughout the novel, you know, that sort of thing. But this one is particularly hilarious because when Basilio discovers this man who's prisoner in a pit, before helping him out of the pit, he says to him, "Sir, your situation is the same as that of the protagonists of The Pit and the Pendulum, The Chilling Tale by Edgar Poe. Do you like that author, sir?" And only after that, he proceeds to help him out.
He keeps it interesting then. I mean, he makes fun almost of himself in a way, or the intertextual elements. Not only are they allusions, but he calls attention to them.
That's right. I mean, it's just something that sort of comes out of nowhere, but it's there all right. of a sudden. And you're reading the novel and you're thinking, this is just incredibly funny. You know, and there are some other moments like that. Basilio apparently really likes to gamble. Mm-hmm. He says he never, when he's playing cards, he never gambles on the kings.
Okay.
Because he's a Republican. You know, that sort of thing. You know, and then you hear, you know, because it's kind of a ridiculous joke.
Yeah.
But within the novel, it you know, those moments of comic relief are necessary, and they're very interesting. So I'm very happy that he does that. I think it's one of the things that makes the novel more readable and more palatable to you know, a wider range of audiences, whether they like or know Edgar Allan Poe or not. Right. The fact that he's asking this of a man who has been in a pit for days without drinking, with rats around him, you know, it's that's the first thing question. He thinks of. You know?
Like, do you like that author?
That's right.
It's like finding someone who's been tied up by a serial killer now and saying, have you watched this movie?
Yeah. That? It's like, so yeah, that's stupid. Something like that. Yeah. I mean, it's just one of many attractions of the novel, that it's an oddity as a novel in the 1920s, but it is, I think, really, really recommendable in my from my point of view, and that's why, you know, we've brought it today to Trace in Text. You know, I'm hoping that, you know, if anyone out there who reads Spanish is interested in the novel, it's fairly easy to find and fairly cheap to buy too. So, you know, I'd like to know what everyone thinks about it, anyone who reads it.
Now, you mentioned that there's a film adaptation. Can you tell us about the film adaptation? And
yes, the film adaptation is sort of obscure, too. Just like the novel has become quite obscure, so is the film adaptation, which was made in 1944, so about 24 years after the original publication of the novel, and it was made by the Spanish writer and filmmaker Edgar Neville, who really was interested in the novel and decided to make an adaptation. I'm not really sure if Emilio Carrere collaborated with Edgar Neville on the script or not, although there are pictures of the two of them together that have survived. I think it's one of the least known movies in the history of Spanish cinema. It was well received by critics at the time, and even today there are some film critics that consider it a masterpiece of Spanish fantasy cinema.
Well, that's too bad that it's so obscure now.
Yes, I can't tell.
Have you watched it?
No, unfortunately I haven't had a chance to watch it because it's not easy to find on DVD.
Okay.
Most of the people that I've talked to who have actually watched it, they watched it on TV because it was shown on Spanish TV at some point. But I have never had the chance to watch it. I hope to watch it someday because based on what I've read about it, it seems at least an interesting movie.
Right.
And of course, it has the same title as the book. But due to the censorship of the Franco regime, Neville had to eliminate any supernatural elements from the film.
So the whole theosophy, all of that part.
I guess he was considered not Catholic enough.
Definitely not Catholic. Well.
But, you know, as a result, the movie apparently, and I say apparently because I haven't seen it, doesn't have the modern feel that the novel does. You know, it's not that the novel is incredibly modern. When you read it, it kind of jumps at you it's very modern. But definitely, it has those elements. Yes.
Right, and they're taken out. So in some ways, it's a simplified to a certain extent, or cleaned up from any of those maybe more subversive things that the Francoist regime doesn't like.
Yes, I suppose that's what it was. But at least, you know, it's a film that's there somewhere,
and hopefully.
We'll get I'll get to watch.
Yeah.
At some point, and that's that film adaptation goes back to the year of 1944, and so if you ever get a chance to watch it,
I would love to watch it. Actually,
jump at the chance because you know,
may
I
not
really
get another chance.
Haven't
so
been
if
able
I'm in
to.
Spain and it's on TV, it's a must watch.
I would say so. Yeah, that's absolutely for sure. And I think, Sylvia, with this, we get to the end of a rather lengthy episode of
Tracing Text
with Anton
and Sylvia.
And we were talking today about Emilio Carrere and having coffee and tea along the way, because, you know, as you can hear the clinking of the
cups
there, in tribute to this fairly obscure writer from the city of Madrid in Spain. Now, Sylvia, next episode is going to be our 10th episode of
Tracing Text.
It's a special occasion. So what are we going to be talking about?
Well, I have been working on or talking about various femme fatales in literature. And I had two Mexican authors previously, but I'm going to talk about a Spanish author. Her name is Ana María Moix, a Catalan writer, and I am going to be looking at her novella, not a short story, not a novel. Mm-hmm. So again, we're looking at a slightly, you know, it's kind of a not too long work, and it's called Las Virtudes Peligrosas.
Okay, well.
So the Dangerous Virtues. And it's a novella I really like, and I hope to share some of my observations with you all.
Now, this episode of Tracing Text will be available on Podomatic.
And iTunes, that you can not only download and listen to, but you can subscribe. So whenever we have a new episode, it'll automatically download to your phone, and you can listen to it, you know, whenever you like. It's a great thing to have.
And it will also be available on YouTube.
You can also find it. You always post that as well.
Yeah, that's right. And do we have a way to get in touch with us in case anybody in the audience would like to let us know anything?
Right. If you have questions or comments that we welcome, you can email us at tracingtext@gmail.com. And that's lowercase tracingtexts@gmail.com.
Well, thank you so much, Sylvia. I had a great time talking about Emilio Carrere.
And I learned a lot about Emilio Carrere.
And I apologize for messing up the name of the person that batted the work. It's Jesús de Aragón.
Like the region.
Not Jesús. That's right. Like the region in northeastern Spain. That's right.
So thank you so much for listening. And I guess until next time.
We'll be back here on Tracing Text, signing off from
deep in the heart of
the state of Tennessee.